Iambic Audiobooks presents Like Sun by Felicia Luna Lemus, read by Kristen Hughes. Prologue. March 5th, 2003, Ash Wednesday, New York City. All things considered, the flight home was uneventful. I watched a dumb romantic comedy and I ate soggy broccoli in a dinner roll from the crummy free meal when it came around. After the trays were cleared, I stood in line and brushed my teeth in one of the tiny metal bathrooms. My left arm, swollen and throbbing in its plaster cast, I took some aspirin. Eventually I crashed for a few hours and tried my damnedest to prepare for a time-pressed dash out of the airport. Finally, 3 in the morning, careful of my broken arm and the scabbed skin on my chest, I hopped a locked gate and walked across Tompkins Square Park to the Temperance Fountain. The Temperance Fountain, a Victorian stone structure of humble elegance, distant cousin to the crumbling WPA fountain my father courted my mother at before they totally hated each other. The Temperance Fountain, also not so entirely unlike the Mexico City Fountain, where my father's mother sat when she broke Naui Olin's heart. Family cycle come full circle, there I was, a man of 30, standing at a fountain taking my turn. The wind picked up and I smelled pine. No forests anywhere nearby, only patches of dead landscaping and dirty ice all around. The woodsy olfactory effect was merely a pleasant byproduct of the Christmas trees municipal services collected all January and crushed into mulch. I reminded myself that the smell, crisp and refreshing as it may have seemed, was still one of decomposition. A sharp gust of cold air cut through my clothes, chills shivering up my spine. I breathed into my hands for warmth and continued waiting. I'd wait all night if that's what it took. Damn, I'd wait for the rest of my life if I had to. And why not? I had only nothing and everything to lose. My father would have understood. Part 1, Chapter 1, March 1, 1995, Ash Wednesday, Los Angeles. "The doctors tell me I'm dying. Let's go for a nice lunch," he said. What a fucking crappy way to wake up. Still in bed, I pressed the phone closer against my ear. "Dad?" "I'm at the VA in Westwood," he said. "Main entrance." And before I could answer, protest, or even just ask a question like, "Where have you been for the past 15 years? He hung up. My father, Francisco Cruz, the ultimate drama queen. Eventually, he would even die on Father's Day, at sunrise, with me at his side. Seriously, he was such a theatrical bastard. This being the case, it came as little surprise when, although we'd been estranged since I was a kid, he called out of the blue to announce both his impending death and his desire for a lunch date. As if the fates would have allowed it any other way, I had the day off from my crap job stocking bins at Aaron's Records. So after I hung up the phone, I pushed myself out of bed and got ready to meet my dad. The prospect of seeing my father must have left me looking scared or just simply like shit, because one of my roommates stopped me as I was about to walk out of the apartment.
"Frank, everything okay?" Jen asked.
And this may not seem like much, but it was. That's not to say Jen was some sort of bitch who didn't care. It's just that she and her boyfriend Ted usually minded their own business. Really, they were perfect roommates. Both referred to themselves as preppy punk, like it was their way of trying to impress me, like they were so transgressive and cool. But honestly, they were pretty square. Comfortingly predictable, sweet, and dull, Jen and Ted were grad students at UCLA, older than me and way more mellow. We all liked each other enough, none of us flaked on our bills. We cleaned up our own messes, but like I said, it wasn't typical that I'd get in their space or that they'd get in mine. So anyway, given Jen's sudden concern, I figure I must have looked like a total wreck when I was leaving to meet my father. "Yeah, everything's fine," I replied and continued out the door. "Thanks, though." Jen didn't seem convinced. There was no reason she should have been. She stood in the doorway of our Echo Park apartment and watched as I crossed the street, like she thought I might pass out or throw myself in traffic. I got in my rusty tin can little car, forced a smile, and waved to her as I drove away. 40 minutes of cross-town side roads hell later, I pulled my car up to the hospital's main entrance red zone.
A man sat on the concrete slab bench near the automatic sliding glass doors. My father. I hadn't seen him since I was 8, but I would have known him anywhere. In fact, my father and I looked exactly alike. Rather, we shared nearly identical features. But whereas I was dressed in post-teen skater slop, he was dressed to the nines. Fedora cocked on his pomade sleek head, his brown wool three-piece suit slightly wrinkled from a night spent in the hospital, but no worse for the wear. He looked like a Hitchcock flick leading man. Polished wingtip shoes, pocket square, cashmere dress socks. This was the way he had always dressed. Case in point. When I was in kindergarten, there'd been a big weekend carnival at school. It was the most awesome event of the year. There were tons of rides and booths. My favorite booth was the one where kids threw ping-pong balls into fish bowls. And if a kid got enough balls in, the carnies would give them a little plastic bag filled with water and a goldfish. I didn't win a fish, but I did get the consolation prize. A fish-shaped cutout made of red plastic paper like a spotlight gel. You were supposed to hold the plastic paper fish in the palm of your hand, and depending on how its tail and head curled, it predicted your fortune. There were instructions on decoding the curls printed on the little white and red envelope the fish came in. My fish's sides kept curling up. I don't remember what that meant. Really, the curling was just a matter of body heat affecting the onion skin thin plastic, but to me, it was pure magic. Anyway, the carnival had been on one of my dad's weekends, and that event marked the first time I realized my dad was unlike everyone else's dads. All the other fathers were dressed in totally casual outfits, jeans and trainers, some with turtlenecks and denim jackets, others with V-neck sweaters over T-shirts. Almost all of them had shaggy hair and sideburns. They simply looked cool. When we got home from the carnival, I asked my dad why he didn't wear comfortable clothes like theirs, why he went to the barber shop every week and shaved twice a day. "Don't ever let anyone call you a lazy wetback," he said. I had no idea how that was an answer to my question. I tried asking my magic fish, but upon closer inspection, its envelope claimed it could tell me only if I was in love, lucky, or tired. 15 years later, I'd been dealt enough jabs, including one incident in junior high, when a group of kids threw handfuls of pennies at me, called me a beaner queer whore, and were only reprimanded by the lunch supervisor to sit down and eat, that I'd come to understand my father's reasons for wanting to present a polished front. His attire and grooming was passive resistance of a most dignified form. And so, there he sat on the concrete hospital bench, his manicured hands primly folded on his knees, back straight, clean-shaven face tilting side to side slightly as he listened to the sounds around him. As I approached, his body turned static. I stood directly in front of him, and still, he didn't stand. He only adjusted his glasses, as if there was a chance in hell this might help him to recognize me any better. His glasses. Opaque dark brown lenses framed by bulky rectangular solid side panels. An expensive version of the throwaway pairs ophthalmologists give patients after dilation. A more serious version of those many an old man put over the top of regular glasses to filter out all the sun's light. My father was wearing what, as a kid, I'd so bluntly referred to as his blind man glasses. "Dad?"
"Francisca, baby girl."
I cringed, but didn't say anything. He rose to greet me, facing slightly right of where I stood. "Ready to go?" he asked, like he had come to pick me up. I put my hand on his left elbow, and after a briefly awkward moment, led him to the car. "Where should we eat?" he asked, as if this was a casual little lunch date we had every week.
"Wherever."
"Cantor's?"
"Sure."
I drove east on Sunset, and then on to Santa Monica Boulevard. We'd made it all the way to Fairfax and were heading south before I got up the nerve to ask what was going on.
"Let's talk while we eat," he said.
"Fine. A supposedly dying man should be granted such requests, right?" We arrived at Cantor's. I parked in the side lot, took a ticket from the attendant, and led my father into the restaurant. A comforting stink of sugar cookies, pastrami, and pickle juice greeted us. So did one of Cantor's many venom-spitting, charm-haggard waitresses. My father and I sat at a table for two in the main dining room, under the stained glass false ceiling that looked like a canopy of giant autumnal trees. Why the New England forest motif in a Los Angeles Jewish deli? Don't know. But the resulting effect was simultaneously unsettling and perfect. The second we sat down, I did what I always did when I got to Cantor's. I picked up the telephone. Like every other booth, ours came outfitted with an old-fashioned black telephone mounted on the mottled glass that divided the booth into its own little cubicle. You could make local calls for free from your table. I wasn't actually going to call anyone, but the gimmick was too good not to be acknowledged each visit. So I picked up the phone, but there was no dial tone. I clicked the receiver hook. Nothing. The line was dead. My dad must have heard me futzing. He said, "Your mother didn't say much when I called to get your number. How is she?" "Don't know, really." "That bad?" "Yeah." I couldn't see behind his glasses, but I was pretty certain two heavy-lidded eyes, precisely the same shape as mine, went sad in response. My father took off his fedora and placed it on the table next to the napkin dispenser. With hands as big and bony and slightly freckled as mine, he smoothed his hair into place and sighed. It was such an uncanny thing to sit across from a person I resembled so exactly, but with whom I'd spent so little of my life. That said, I knew it hadn't been my father's fault we were near strangers. The custody battle that ensued after my mother left him had been extremely messy, to say the least. By the time I was 8, my mother had done all she could, and she did a lot, to end my relationship with my dad. Still, there was no doubt about it. I was his kid. "Son," our waitress interrupted our silence, "you ready to order?" Not that my father could see it, but his little girl had become a young man. Starting in junior high, I'd wound ace bandages tight around my chest to flatten my thankfully negligible breasts. Hoping for the healing benefits of a cold compress, I'd initially stored the bandages in the freezer overnight. Over time, I'd acquired less chilling and more sophisticated means for smoothing things out, and by the time I sat across from my dad at Cantor's, I'd mastered counterbalancing most physical evidence of ever having been born a girl. The careful staging our waitress unknowingly tested with her impatient stare. A baggy long-sleeved black t-shirt, over a tight Hanes undershirt, over a wife beater, over an extra-small binder. Boxer shorts peeking out from under low-slung, oversized black dickies, cinched with an army surplus canvas belt. A bulky dark gray hoodie sweatshirt, hood down. I pulled the visor of my baseball cap further over my face, shuffled my skater sneaker clumsy feet, and cleared my throat to deepen my voice for a response. "Son?" she repeated. "I'll just have a coffee," my father answered before I could, oblivious to the way I looked, flattered by what he'd taken to be a waitress's flirtation directed at him. He was totally clueless, but still, I'd passed in front of my father. I ordered a celery soda to mark the occasion. What other options were there? Sweet fizz celebration was the best I could do. "So, Dad, can we talk now?" I watched as my father responded by retrieving a black Sharpie from his jacket pocket. He took several napkins from our table's dispenser, unfolded the white squares, and spread them out on the table in front of him. As we waited for our food, he mapped out a diagram of what he was leaving me in death. His blindness. I would inherit my father's ticking time bomb vision. I'd always known my father had been dealt a particularly bad set of eyes. But now he told me the specifics of his deteriorating eyesight. By the time he was 7, he'd needed Coke bottle glasses. As a teenager, he'd required a magnifying glass to read the Bible, as his mother insisted he do each Sunday morning. These details didn't make sense. I'd just picked him up from the VA hospital. He'd fought in Vietnam. Wasn't there an eye exam when you got drafted? Once Uncle Sam found me, nothing mattered except trying to get me killed. And then he started in on a rant about how Vietnam had never been his war to fight, about how he'd grown up in Mexico, with no clue he'd been born in the States. So why should he have had to go to war for this country? And unbelievable as it may have seemed, it was true. He really hadn't known he was a U.S. citizen until he was drafted. He also hadn't known until he was 18 that when his mother was pregnant with him, his family had gone north as braceros to build railroads. 1943, Chicago. And yet another detail you'd figure most people would know about their own lives. He hadn't learned until he was a grown man that he'd once had a sister. Rosario Maria Guadalupe Cruz. My father's sister, Rosario, had been 4 years old when the family went north. And when the family came home less than a year later, she was no longer with them. Rosario met tragedy while she and her newborn brother were living with their parents, along with thousands of other government-indentured Bracero Program laborers, in a Chicago Railroad Company's shantytown. Their makeshift home was constructed out of barely modified old train cars located on a dusty stretch of land adjacent to a strip of railroad. The living and working conditions were barely one step from slavery. My father's mother was a proud woman. She didn't like leaving her home country to be so shamed. Hard work didn't upset her, but a lack of dignity did. She had wanted to be treated with respect, and she longed to spend more time with her newborn son. She wished she didn't have to leave him every day with the old woman who came to the shantytown each morning before dawn and watched the workers' children for a hefty cut of their pay. My dad said that his mother once admitted that in Chicago, after a particularly trying day of breaking stone into gravel, to be laid out under the tracks, she had cursed God for giving her such a trying life. She told my father she'd forever regret that moment of weakness, because a few days later, in what she interpreted as retribution for her ingratitude, the railroad, that angry and almighty steel and oil god of industry, threw thunderbolts at her. Quick rumble flash, a supply train derailed. Heavy weight skipped thick tracks. Screech metal snapped. Rattle impact. The train crashed into the perimeter of the shantytown. In the bright sunshine middle of the day, it was a pretty day, a very pretty day. The camp was near empty. Most everyone was working far from there. Few were injured. Only one died. Rosario had been playing by the side of the railroad. My father's mother, devastated by her little girl's death, refused to speak a word of their time in Chicago. She forbade her husband or anyone else ever to mention it. As it turned out, the gods weren't done with the family yet. One afternoon, 5 years later, the trio settled back into their lives in Mexico. My father, now a young boy, was helping his father tend to the family's small farm. His mother was inside their shack home, presumably preparing supper. My father felt shivers on his arm as a sudden thunderstorm filled the sky with electric air and heavy raindrops. When a thunderclap rattled the field, his mother must have thought of the shanty town in Chicago. She would have thought of her little girl. A lightning bolt outside, too close outside, too near the house, much too close, shook my father's mother to the core. And outside in the field, my father watched as celestial brilliance reached down and anointed his father. Singed black to his toes, the man died instantly. One could conclude, and many did, that traces of the flash seared my father's vision, swam through the veins of his eyes, and although it took many years, slowly turned him blind. Unfortunately, my father was not yet blind the day his pueblo's grocer, who was also the post general, found him at Sunday service, and told him of the letter waiting. "It looks important, Francisco. It's from up north." With nothing more than a piece of paper translated by the grocer into Spanish, the U.S. government took the farm tools from my father's hands, forced him to report to San Diego for processing, taught him how to shoot a rifle, and shipped him to a jungle in Vietnam. 13 months of hell later, my father returned to Mexico speaking English and with ever-worsening eyesight. Soon thereafter, he decided to move to the States, a country he had never seen with clear eyes, to embark on his newfound birthright, the American dream. "Mommy, come with me," he said to his mother. "We'll get you papers." "I won't go," she said. "It'll be good." "No." His mother knew that the roads up north were not paved in gold. But even after 2 years of an American war, My father was still naive enough to hope for the best. As he boarded a bus north, his mother took his hand and in his open palm she placed a small honey-colored pebble, a memento she'd picked up once long ago as she walked along a rural dirt road leading to church. "Remember your home." My father kissed the pebble and tucked it in his pocket for safekeeping. He hugged his mother and told her he loved her. He promised to write often, to send money, and visit as soon as he could. He followed through on most of his promises, but he never saw his mother alive again. Slowly, my father built a life for himself. He found employment, worked long hours, tried to save money, fell in love. But no matter what he did, his world still blurred and darkened with each passing year. When I was a child, he often held me close. Not exactly out of intense affection, but more specifically, knowing one day he might wake without the ability to see anything at all, to memorize the features of my person. More years went by, more work, less love, less money saved, on and on. All throughout my childhood, my mother had tried to make me hate my father. Her efforts were useless. I'd always respected my father, if for no other reason than his ability to strike out on his own, to leave home far behind and just go. Countless were the times I'd wanted to follow his example, but I'd always been too chicken shit. Sure, I'd moved to the big city thrill of Los Angeles the instant I graduated from high school, but please, my disaster of a childhood home and mother were barely 45 minutes south. And, although we stayed out of touch and our paths never crossed amidst the sprawl of L.A., my father and I did both live in the same county. Ultimately, my move toward independence was like that of a kid who said he was going to run away and then went and pitched a tent in the backyard instead. So there I was, wishing I could be far, far away from everything I'd ever known. And yet, I sat in a booth at Cantor's with my father. Me, a 22-year-old, with the self-absorbed, myopic vision of youth. And my father, a middle-aged blind man. "It's called retinitis pigmentosa," he said. The condition, he explained, caused degenerative eyesight and eventual blindness, and it skipped generations. "So I don't have it?" I asked, ashamed to be so hopeful. "No, you do." Our order arrived. I bit into my sandwich for distraction. The blindness actively affected only males, my father said. But female offspring of the blind generation carried the gene and could pass the blindness to their male children. "You," my father emphasized, "are a carrier." I choked a little on a dry bit of rye bread, more at my father's loud insistence that I was female than at learning my hypothetical son might be blind. Throat cleared with a swig of soda, I asked, "And retinitis pigmentosa is a terminal illness?" "What?" "You said when you called, the doctors told you..." "Oh no, that's unrelated." He waved his hand as if to shoo away an irrelevant and bothersome topic. "The pain in my gut got so bad last week that I called my doctor. They ran tests at the hospital. The pathologist says he found cancer. They'll operate, but they think it might keep spreading." The pain in his gut? What the fuck was he talking about? He mentioned it like it was some long-standing topic we'd discussed endless times before. The elephant my father tried to ignore sat himself directly on my chest. I was stunned, confused, and speechless. "Anyhow, if you ever get pregnant," he said almost cheerily, "there are options." He uncapped his Sharpie and felt for the paper napkins he'd spread on the table between us. At the center of the napkins, he drew a circle that was supposed to represent me. The marker's ink bled out in a spindly spiderweb mess as he drew another line. He meant the line to start at the circle's perimeter and extend outward. Instead, the line intersected the circle, and I thought of that old magic trick where the magician saws his assistant in half. I'd always hated that trick. I knew it was all smoke and mirrors, but there was something inherently creepy about the illusion. What if something went wrong and the assistant really got sawed in two? What then? "You could selectively abort," my father said, and wrote a jumble of overlapping letters I presumed would have read abort if he could have seen his own writing. I know it sounds awful, but it's an option, he said. A searing hot pain surged in my stomach. My pastrami on rye threatened to travel upward and out. I pressed on my wrists to stay grounded and try not to puke. My discomfort was not caused by the thought of an abortion per se, but by having a conversation with my father, who just breezily revealed he'd been diagnosed with terminal cancer, about being pregnant and selectively aborting a baby boy who might be blind because of something I had apparently inherited. The situation sucked. Dad, by the time you'd want a baby, he marched on, doctors might be able to manipulate an embryo's chromosomes. It'd be expensive, but be sure at least to ask. He found the left edge of the napkins, dragged his index finger halfway across, and drew another line from where he imagined his circle daughter to be. He wrote a long, tangled mess of totally illegible letters that he probably intended to read artificial insemination or test tube baby, but could just as accurately read, I'm a freak show and you're a freak show and any kid you have will be a freak show too. Really, Paquita, it's amazing what science can control, he said. There we were, living proof to the contrary. My chromosomes defined me as a daughter, and cancer was irreversibly sabotaging my father on the most essential of cellular levels. Our bodies were failing us in ways science could never entirely repair. Dad, are you scared? Such a stupid question, but I asked it. He sighed. The skin on his face hung loose and pallid. He was going to die, soon, sooner than either of us realized. He sipped from his heavy ceramic mug of coffee, black, two sugars, plastic brown stirring stick still in the mug. Dad? He reached his hand across the table, and I met him halfway with mine. With a squeeze as warm as his sick flesh could afford, he said, I don't want to die alone. And then he cried, openly, loudly, uncontrollably. I silently vowed to be the perfect son. End of chapter 1.